Michael?
Hello, Dave.
Spinning.
Hello, hello.
It is nice to talk to you again.
You too. Greetings.
Been a little while. You know, our schedules, it's hard to connect. It's all we can do. It's all two men can do to connect.
Hey.
Every week or 2 weeks to talk about cartoons and movies.
Yep. It's New Year, same us.
Yeah, so far. But we're going to change that.
Doing what we can.
Yes, we are. This is like, you know, there's the dog days of summer, which is probably like, you know, July when it's just hot, especially when you're a kid. It's just hot and nothing to do.
Especially when you're at Disney and it's hot in July.
Yeah. We are like firmly ensconced in, I don't know. It's the dog days of winter. I don't know if there's an opposite of dog days of summer, but that's what this is. Like it's middle of January. Well, end of January when we record this, and I got one of those therapy lights, and you know, that you just like, it's supposed to mimic sunlight or whatever. And you know, the instructions said not to run it for more than like 30 or 40 minutes at a time. And I just blast this thing in my face like 6 hours a day, just trying to keep my decent mood.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the sun just peeked its head out, but I'm sure that the sun will, you know, we're here in Ohio, so it is pretty gloomy. There's needs no to be an equivalent to dogs.
From about now till May, we'll see the sun twice, I think.
Two times. Well, yeah. And hey, I mean, my New Year's resolutions are going good. But, you know, I really am struggling with wanting to get outside more. And that's been difficult when it's been, you know, wintry out. So I don't blame you for that light, you know.
Welcome to the Edmore Mouse Podcast, everybody. My name is Dave.
And I am Mike. Greetings to all.
And this is, you know, a podcast that talks about, we try to find things that maybe people haven't covered a billion times already, you know, in reference to the Disney company or the parks or books or movies or whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of Disney podcasts out there. And if you're listening to this one, we appreciate it. And however you found us, thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
And I think we've got a really cool show today. I'm talking to another interview show with a guy named, well, you know what? I'll introduce him in a minute.
Oh, we're gonna little cliffhanger.
Even though I'm going to put his name in the title of the show. So anybody listening to this will know who it is. Michael, how have you been, what have you been doing lately in regards to, you know, your Disney fandom? You watching stuff? Are you reading stuff?
Oh, I've been getting my Disney fix for sure. Disney Plus has been delivering for sure. I know last time we talked about just that onslaught of new spinoffs and TV shows and whatnot that are going to be appearing over the course of the next couple of years with like Marvel and the whole Marvel verse and how crazy it is and how it's sort of an ongoing theme I mentioned in my life where it's like I struggle with, you know, do you want to dive in because there's just so much. So I did decide, hey, I'm going to watch the brand new show that they just came out with from the Marvel Universe, give it a shot, and it's WandaVision. So that's, of course, with Scarlet Witch and Vision, who, I mean, the premise is just so strange to even talk about, and I know that I don't want to give a lot away because I think that it's slowly and surely going to sort of reveal itself to be what it truly is. There's been three episodes so far, and it's just super cool. The first episode starts as kind of like a parody of like a 50s, 60s black and white sitcom where they're living in that house with like a laugh track, Wanda and Vision together in this house and in this neighborhood trying to conceal their superpower identities from their neighbors. Kind of weird, but you know it doesn't last that way throughout the whole series. I think there's more to this that it's going to start to unfold. So I think the approach is fresh and different because it's completely unlike the formula we've seen with, you know, what 25 Marvel movies that have been that have been released over the years. So that to me was pretty exciting. And I recommend it for that reason, because it's so different.
Yeah, I've seen the first two episodes, and I'm in. My wife is not sure how she feels about it, but I like it. And different about it. I kind of, there's going to be plenty of other Marvel content coming to Disney Plus that is, I think, probably more along the lines of your standard, what you would expect from Marvel movies, things like that. Like there's the show, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, that looks very much like what you would expect, having seen like the Captain America movies. But yeah, I think it's super cool. And sounds like it's going to be kind of a segue going into some of the weirdness that is supposed to be all throughout what they're calling the Marvel Phase 5, which is getting into the weird galactic characters and getting into space and the multiverse and all things like that. So yeah, I think it's like a cool segue into some, hopefully some weirder stuff. That was always my favorite stuff when I was a kid, when I read comics, besides Spider-Man. I always liked the weird cosmic entities that, the weird stuff. I was an extra nerd. Go ahead.
It kind of, I was just gonna say, I think it kind of you know, for real fans of Marvel, like real Marvel nerds, I've talked to a couple of them who they would call themselves that. That's not an insult. There's all sorts of hidden Easter eggs, and there's lots of theories out there and stuff too. And lots of like little things that the average viewer might not realize, but then when I'm told, then I, you know, it's really kind of neat how they hide things in like fake commercials and just little things that you, if you'd have to rewatch, you could see. So I like that too.
Very cool. For some reason, I got a hankering for some old Disney stuff. And I watched for the first time the original 1950s Absent-Minded Professor movie. Have you ever seen that?
I have, but I mean, it's been since I was a kid. And you said this was one of your resolutions in our previous episode.
Yeah, so it was just, you know, to go back and watch some of the older stuff that I've never seen. And I don't know, there's just something... There's something very comforting about some of those old movies. You know, The Absent-Minded Professor, it's pretty weird. But it has some really cool imagery. It has some really cool, like, you know, vintage special effects, which actually don't look that bad. And so I don't know. I had a lot of fun watching it. It's something you can put on and not have to think too much about, but it's, you know, it gives you a little piece of like that Disney history, those properties that we're keeping Disney, you know, TV and Disney theater productions alive. It's just interesting. I also, after we finished that, I queued up the first Davy Crockett movie. Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. And this is the first time I've seen this pop up for Disney Plus. But when you click on it, you get a screen that kind of it. Well, not kind of. It very clearly lays out that what you're about to see has very not okay depictions of other races. Yeah, this is the first time I've seen this, and I think it's super interesting. And I took a screenshot, so I'm going to read it. Hold on 1 second, I'll pull it up. And you know, one thing I like about it is that they don't use the word outdated. So, you know, some people will say, oh, those, you know, I've seen actually for some of the Warner Brothers movies, it'll say, or like the Warner Brothers cartoons, it'll say, you know, the following cartoon contains outdated depictions of, you know, other cultures. And, you know, that kind of means that at some point those depictions were okay. Well, right. They're only okay when, you know, we didn't talk about those kinds of things. So I took a screenshot of the message that pops up when you click on Davy Crockett, and this is what it says. This program includes negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now. Rather than remove this content, we want to acknowledge its harmful impact, learn from it, and spark conversation to create a more inclusive future together.
Disney is committed to creating stories with inspirational and aspirational themes that reflect the rich diversity of the human experience around the globe. And then they give you a link to disney.com/storiesmatter. And I have not checked that out. So I don't quite know what that takes you, but I prefer that they do it this way. I think this stuff should be available. I think it's historically important. And also there are still, you know, older people who recognize this stuff. And if it's a chance to convince them or let them know, like, hey, it's okay to watch this because you liked it when you were a kid. But I think we also need to acknowledge that, you know, it's not, this is not okay the way these people are depicted.
Yeah, that distinction of how they worded that is really applaudable.
It's far more forceful than what I would have expected from them, and I think that's to be commended. I will say this: watching it last night, I watched the first 40 minutes, and you know, it's an amazing looking film. That it's, you know, shot. There's some really great nature in there. I mean, it's a really interesting artifact, and obviously D.V. Crockett was hugely important to the Disney company. They used to show it, as part of the Disney TV programs. And so, you know, if you're a Disney historian or a Disney history buff like us, I think it's, you know, super interesting to watch. But it definitely, there are parts that are pretty squirmy with how Native Americans are treated. That's what I've been indulging in Disney Plus. Anything else on your end?
Well, just one real quick thing is that they have the new Pixar popcorn.
Yeah, I saw the icon for this, but I have not watched it.
Yes. Well, it will take you all but 10 minutes to watch all 10 of these, I would say. Maybe a little bit over that. But honestly, it is so, these are like super short little, I like to say little palate cleansers, little nuggets of some of our Pixar favorites returning. It literally, some of them don't even have any dialogue, I think probably because they didn't want to enlist the talents of people like Tim Allen and Ellen DeGeneres just to speak for like two seconds. But they are all these, the classic Pixar films that everyone loves. And again, 10 of these, just they're all very different. Some of them are more touching. Some of them are just complete slapstick humor. My favorite one of the 10, because I watched them all in one sitting because, again, does not take long. Surprisingly was Cars. They did one called Unparalleled Parking, and it was just a real funny little skit. And then surprisingly there was Dory Finding was like kind of the Finding Nemo one. And she, you know, kept finding little items, and I don't know, just wasn't as, usually I would laugh a lot more at Finding Nemo, but that's the only criticism I have. I mean, really, they were all just so fun. And then, of course, I just hope in the future that some of the other Pixar films, if they keep making these, that they, you know, bring in things like Monsters, Inc. and WALL-E and Up, because they weren't represented. But regardless, really funny.
It's so.
And I will say, later this year, there's going to be that Doug Days, which is a Disney Plus series with Doug, the dog from Up. So, you know, we'll get a good dose of Up.
Yeah, well, this is what I was hoping for when they first announced Disney Plus. It's like they're just churning out content, and it's so cool to like stumble upon stuff that maybe you didn't even know they were going to put out. I wasn't going to mention this, but I just thought of it while you were talking. I know in February, like we said, we're recording this in January. In February, a filmed version of their Epcot Illuminations show is coming on to Disney Plus. And like, that's one of my favorite parts of Epcot. You know, it's been discontinued. It was replaced by a show called Epcot Forever, and then is being replaced, if not already, it's being replaced by a show called what is it called?
I don't know. Epcot.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called.
That's okay.
Harmonious Us.
There you go. Yes. Us with the US.
Yes. So, you know, it's long gone, but I got to see it a bunch of times as a kid and then as an adult, and I loved it. And so I'm kind of really excited that there's going to be hopefully like this professionally filmed version of it coming to Disney Plus. And I hope they put more of those out. You know, like I would love to see a version of Wishes from a few years back, which is the Magic Kingdom nighttime show. Yeah, I think I love that they're mixing in some of the park stuff. I think that's really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I know you had like a really good interview with lined up for our listeners.
Yes, so today we're going to flip over to this interview with Matthew Parrish, who he's like, I think I was like starstruck by him, even though it made him feel like supremely awkward. But he's been doing podcasts for forever. He started the Wedway Radio podcast like 12 years ago with his brother Nate. And in the last 4 years, he's been doing the one that how I discovered him, which is the 3028 podcast he does with his co-host Kevin Quigley. I'm going to get Kevin on the show too. We've been talking. He's going to come on eventually. He's a really interesting guy as well. As an adult going to the parks, you know, I got into podcasts and was looking for more information, and his 3028 show, I don't even know how I stumbled upon it, but it was just one of the best ones because it's one of the shows that the style I kind of aspire to, which is that it's something that it's made by two people who clearly love the parks. Mostly it's a park show. They do talk about the movies occasionally, but it's mostly centered on the different parks in the world. But it's not two guys who are, you know, they don't make a living off of it. They don't make any money off of it. It's just two people who like to do it because it's a way to talk about something they both enjoy. And, you know, if you want to hear a really good podcast, go listen to 3028, go listen to Wedway Radio. The editing, the music beds he makes, this is a real rinky-dink operation we have running over here at Admore Mouse. And that's squarely on me being the editor-in-chief. I don't know. I had Matt on. I wanted to talk to him about really everything. It was kind of like when I talked to Karen Schreiner, who's a cast member, who I had like 1,000 questions. I had to narrow it down to something that would be, you know, semi listenable to the general public. Matt is featured in a book that just came out. I'm going to read the title here. It's called It All Started With a Blog: Detangling the Wide Web of Disney Bloggers. And it's by a guy named Paul Lane. You can get it on Amazon. There's an ebook version. It's in paperback. I have not read it yet, but I think it's kind of about this crop of Disney bloggers and podcasters who have sprung up to talk about the stuff that they like. And so I figured that was a good reason to have him on. And we talked all about how he got started, changes he's seen in the parks over the last few decades. He's been going since he was a little kid. And then I had this theory of trying to understand what's happening with the parks currently in the face of the global coronavirus pandemic and see if there are parallels to what happened to the parks after 9/11 when travel was just decimated. And it's kind of a harebrained parallel I was drawing, and Matt was able to find some ways that it's similar, but a lot of ways that it's just, you can't compare the two. So I think also because we're separated by an hour, and we had to do it when everybody's kids were in bed. This was like the latest I stayed up in a really long time. I'm talking like past midnight. And, you know, ooh. I was not drinking much during the interview, but I think towards the end, you'll hear me getting a little slurry. And I want to let you know that is not because I was tired. I was totally wrapped by what he was saying, but I was in that tired mode where like I was wired, but also like, my motor skills were starting to shut down. So there's one point where I try to say the word, there was a point where I tried to say the word unprecedented, and it just kind of came out like unprecedented, and purely sleep deprivation, people, I promise. Yeah.
Disclaimer.
Well, I'll see you on the other side. And everybody, I hope you enjoy this discussion with Matt Parrish from the 3028. Matt, are you here?
I'm here.
Awesome. I'm so excited. I can't tell you how much I love your show. I've listened to it since basically, I think I found it right after it started, and which is shocking because of the title. I don't know how I found it. The 3028 I'm talking about. It's so good. And it like coincided with, I needed to find something about Disney history that was not super dry, and somehow came across your podcast, and it's so good. And if anybody is listening to this show and has not listened to that show, I don't know what you're doing, but you can pause this and go listen to whatever the newest episode of 3028 is, and then come back to this, and it will make a lot more sense to you.
Yes, pause and go over there.
And then
leave this show immediately.
But, and you know what? I don't get paid for this. You don't have to come back. But I mean, I would appreciate you coming back. It would be nice.
They'll come back.
All right. So I did your intro coming in, but you know, you've been doing this for longer than I've had children, which is amazing to me. And so, you know, I've heard you talk about on your show that you were, I think, probably one of the early adopters of the Disney Vacation Club, your family was. So I kind of want to know how this all started for you. I know it happened when you were a kid, but like, how did this happen for you?
Like just being a theme park fan?
I guess, yeah.
Like the whole Disney thing? Well, you know, I was three when the Disney Channel became a thing on cable television, right? So my first memories of watching TV are the Disney Channel, because we had that, Nickelodeon and ESPN and a couple of others, because we were a test home for cable. So we had lots of cable channels. This is a really weird thing, like in HBO. So like, I knew these things when I was like 3 or 4 or 5 years old. And so I remember as a kid watching very early weird Disney Channel stuff, like DTV and like Welcome to Pooh Corner, Dumbo Circus. Like these were all my shows. And so like that was my first, like the things I remember as a kid are like those things. And then, you know, moving on through the 80s, probably 1987, my mom, she got remarried, and she and my dad used to go to Disney with the kids. And then when she got remarried, she introduced my stepdad, who's still my stepdad, to Disneyland. They went to Disneyland on their, I guess when they eloped or whatever. And then they were like, well, we need to take the kids to Walt Disney World. So 1987, we took one of these like National Lampoons. The door fell off the minivan on the way. Three kids are throwing up in the backseat, kind of trips. And
was it the sliding door that you had to,
yes,
like, you had to throw all of your weight behind? Yeah.
If a kid got their arm in it would no longer have an arm.
Yeah. My first car, when I turned 16 in high school, I inherited my parents' 1988 Dodge Caravan.
Yes.
And
every one of my friends' parents had that car, by the way.
That was my car. As long as I drove my brother to school, I could drive it. And I had perfected the move where like people would pile into the car and have the door open, and then I would, you know, hit the gas, but then hit the brake and the door would slam shut.
Oh yeah. That's automatic. You made it automatic.
Looking back, like you just said, it's amazing that any of my friends have fingers and hands left, because they were probably reaching to close it right before I was like, no, I got it. And then just hit the gas. Bad idea. Anyways, go on. I'm sorry.
Anyway, it was one of those trips and the door fell off and all that stuff. And my little sister ate some random pizza from under a hotel bed on that trip. So all those things happened. We went to the Magic Kingdom, went to Epcot. It was the worst trip we've ever had. And then a couple years later, we went again, and it was like the greatest trip ever. And so all these, you know, we just went to Disney. We didn't go to Space Center. We didn't go to Silver Dollar City or anything like we did the first time. And then this time was just Disney. We stayed at the Polynesian, and that was it. I was hooked. Staying at the Seven Seas Lagoon Resort as a 9-year-old kid, I immediately went home. I went to the library. I checked out a book on like 1970s Walt Disney World. And I, you know, aside from like a few years where I was too cool, like, it's really just been a huge part of my life.
That was one of the things I was going to ask. I actually have it written down where I was going to say, like, was there a time where you decided that, you know, you were either too old for it or, you know, no, this isn't something I'm supposed to like or admit to liking?
I'm sure there was some of that, but like, I don't think it was as like a conscious thing. Honestly, in the latter Michael Eisner years, there were just no updates at the theme parks. And like, we were still going like multiple times a year. And I'm like, I've done all of this so many times. Like, I was just in need of something new. And to be honest with you, like, what made it new again was meeting my wife, who, like, she took one trip as a kid. Like, literally, she went to like North Carolina, Myrtle Beach or something. And that was it. She'd never been anywhere. And I was like, you've never been anywhere. So I took her to Disneyland. Or we went to Walt Disney World for like New Year's Eve, and it was horrible. You couldn't walk. And she was like, we're never going back there. And then when we got married in Vegas, I was like, let's go to Disneyland because I've never been. And we went together. It was like the greatest day ever. And she's been hooked ever since. So it made it new for me again, and it made it fun for me again. And that was right around the same time that we started recording the Wedway Radio Show. And so it all became like new and fresh, and I discovered more than anyone should ever know about Disney history.
That, you know, I'm super envious that you had the wherewithal as a kid to go to the library and learn about this stuff, because for me, I went when I was really little, and I barely remember it. I do remember parts of it, but it's most of it's just like snapshots almost. And then I went again in high school, and I don't know. It just didn't occur to me that, like, it's sort of like when you're a kid and you watch any movie and you don't, at least I never considered, like, who made this movie?
Right.
You
know, it's of like course.
Movies yeah. just show up. You go see a movie and then it's over. And it never occurred to me that, oh, there are humans making this stuff. And that's interesting. And I remember going to Disney World with my family, and in high school, I think maybe I was a sophomore, junior, and I liked it, but it didn't, nothing really grabbed me. And then I went when I was like 28, and I just like, it just fried my brain. And then I was like, what have I been doing? I could have been an Imagineer if I would have discovered this stuff early enough. But
why didn't you plan well, Dave?
Like, that's one thing I've never been good at is planning my life. So it's worked out for me fine so far.
It's going good. You got kids. It worked. You did.
Right. Kids. I got a house. On paper, I look like I'm doing great. So the Wedway Radio Show, you started it 12 years ago.
Oh, and yeah.
So I have two questions, and they probably have big answers. But the first one is, you know, what on earth did podcasting look like 12 years ago? Because I really can't remember a time now, like, since I got an iPhone, like, podcasts have been a thing. And clearly there are, we're kind of living in peak podcast right now. We're like, I'll have an idea for something really goofy. I had an idea a couple weeks ago about, maybe I should do a show where I review the fashion on Full House episodes. And there's already two of those.
Oh, so, no. Like, what?
Yeah. No matter what I think of, somebody's already thought of it. And so I can only imagine, like, what was podcasting like 12 years ago? And then I'll hit you with my follow-up question after you answer that one.
I think it's a great question, honestly. I mean, maybe that's a standard question for people who have been doing this for a long time. But seriously, back then, it seemed like you could start a podcast and you would get an audience. And that was true. Like, it was a weird thing. Like, as long as you knew to share, like, on Twitter and Facebook or whatever, I mean, people went to Facebook to really, they didn't go there to complain. They didn't go there to, you know, do a bunch of those games. Remember the big game, you know, Farmville and all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, of course. Right. So like prior to that, like, you were just connecting with people. And so if you started a brand and you connected with people on that brand, like, it would work. And it was this weird new thing. I bet YouTubers have the same experience, like early YouTubers, because there were so few competitors. And that's how it was. I mean, you knew, like, when we started our show, there were already like four or five really big shows. Like, we knew that. But like, think of WDWNT, right? News Today. Well, they coattailed WDW Today, obviously, with their name. But at the same time, like, they hadn't even started, like, when we started. That's weird, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, you think of that, like, that's a standard. Like, people love them or they hate them. They weren't even around at that time. So that tells you, like, the avenue, the lane was bigger. Today, the lane is smaller. And I can tell you the difference between starting a podcast in 08 or 09 and starting it in 2017, like I did with Kevin on the 3028 show. It's probably taken 50 times the work, the branding, the reaching out, the whatever, to get the same audience that we got, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit through our pre-show Facebook chat, but as a musician, it's been a lot of the same thing. And while I'm a firm believer that everybody should have the tools to make stuff and also distribute it, it's definitely been crazy to see, like, and this is all good, but I remember being a kid and, you know, you'd go into a studio and make a demo, right? Three song demo. And then you'd go into the back of Rolling Stone and there would be an ad for $2,000 for 500 CDs with laser printed CD stickers. And now you can record a song today and like upload it, and every single human you've ever known could theoretically hear it. And that's amazing. But also the flip side is that no one is actually going to hear it because everybody's doing it.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't, everything is so saturated. And then beyond that, it's not just saturated. There's another phenomenon happening that's like fragmentation. So even within groups, there are subgroups. And so there are people who listen to podcasts that only like, you know, up to the minute news. And there's some people who only like, you know, well-researched history, and then a million things in between. And so it's so, because there are so many shows and so many ideas and whatever, it's so fragmented that people are so inundated with all these different shows that they can't even find a new show. You know, it's like, it's almost like the internet, right? Think of how many websites there are, but like, how many do you really go to, Dave?
Yeah, sadly, I go to the same ones that I went to 10 years ago, and they stink because they've been, I mean, I hate to throw shade, but like the AV Club is one that I've loved since I was a kid, and it's a shell of its former self. But like, at the same time, it's just like a reflex. I pull up Google and like, I just go, oh, I guess I want some movie news. And even though they don't even have movie news at this point, but I still type in this stupid website.
So social media sort of absorbed a lot of what the World Wide Web was. So if you were looking for something like Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace, right? Like Facebook Marketplace just took over. And so the traffic of websites there's still a zillion websites, but like the traffic is low. And so think about a new website coming online now. Like, how hard would it be to like build a brand if you didn't already have a brand? Like, it would be tough.
Especially when you're trying to like, you know, another thing that I think is really impressive at how early you guys started is that it strikes me as people who, and this is the other question I want to ask you, which is like, how did you and your brother decide to start the show? But I'm going to guess that it's just because it was something you guys had in common and you liked talking about it. And so it was like, oh, that's the thing we should talk about. Whereas now I think there's probably a lot of people who probably start shows or YouTube channels simply because they live near something that gives them access. And with that might come clicks, which comes with YouTube ad revenue. And so it's this whole other scheme of like, what do we do in order to, you know, A, make money, but also curry favor with Disney corporate, who has clearly embraced some of these shows as, you know, eyeball drivers and things like that. So, you know, thinking about how did your brother and you decide to make the show in the first place?
So the biggest show when we started was WDW Today, and that was Matt Hochberg and Mike Scopa and Lynn Testa. And they did this 30-minute show, and they talked about like up to the day news about what was going around Walt Disney World.
And quick question, as somebody who was not around for that, were they doing it just purely out of the fact that they loved the stuff or that they were interested in it? Or was there, again, I'm so jaded because I came into this stuff with like, there's 3,000 Disney shows, and it's all because they're, you know, trying to get invited to early, you know, attraction openings and stuff like that. So it's like charming to me to think of this ragtag group of people who are just like, love this stuff. And so they pull it together to make a show, and it's not with any ulterior motives to like, you know,
yeah,
I don't work for Disney at some point.
Not everybody who listened to, you know, radio in the 20s or even made radio in the 20s did it because they were trying to, you know, make money. They just did it because it was like a hobby. And I think that that's what this was. It connected two things. It connected this interest in the web and into these new technologies, social media, etc., and then what these people loved, which was like Disney. So if you look at Matt Hochberg, not only was he on WDW Today, but he also had the studio, basically a whole website dedicated to Disney MGM Studios that documented all this history for all these years. And so that was a big thing. So people that were already doing like websites, like it was a really easy thing for them to parlay that into a show. And I think for a lot of those people, and a lot of them have gone away, it was a hobby. And then when it became so saturated and fragmented and took up a lot of time and really didn't deliver the, you know, the monetization, I guess maybe they wanted, or maybe just the good feelings they had when they started, much like, you know, making music for a while with certain people. And then all of a sudden you just kind of lose interest, which like every band does. Maybe they didn't want to do it anymore, or maybe it was too time consuming, or they were in a different season of life. So I don't think it's always the profit motive. Like for me, it's never been about profit motive ever.
And so here's a question I did not have written down, but like, why do you keep doing it? So if profit, I mean,
and I think it's like brushing your teeth, dude. I don't know why.
I mean it in like a very genuine, like, what is, and again, I can sort of parallel this to making music. When I really break down my involvement with music at the age of 39 years old, I'm reminded of this pretty great meme that was going around on Facebook, which was, being a musician is driving $5,000 worth of gear in a $500 car to a $50 gig, which is pretty much the story of my musical career. So I kind of, to a certain extent, there's a lot that's like kind of unexplainable as to why you keep doing it. But I mean, do you think it's the production of a thing that drives you, or is it the actual like content? Is it the fact that you like talking about Disney in particular, theme parks in general, or is it just like, I want to make something and Disney's a thing that happens to be the avenue with which I make stuff?
Like six of one, half dozen, right? Like it's a really interesting thing to like own something, you know, like this is your thing. Like, in, I think as an adult, like we go to work somewhere, like that's not our thing. We're just doing work for somebody else. And then like you come home and like you raise your kids, but like their kids, they're their own people, right? So I don't own them. They're doing their own thing. So this is like a thing that I have that's kind of mine. All right. So there's that. And then beyond that, there's a camaraderie when you record with people. Like it's like setting appointments and friend time and hanging out. And that's like a thing. So that's really fun. And then beyond that, like sometimes it's really important to people. Like they get a lot out of it. And if that's the case, that's kind of a special thing. And I appreciate that. And so it makes me want to continue doing it.
It is really cool even with our show, which is me and Michael's show, we put some work into it, but it's a small, I mean, that's a nice way of saying it. It's a small show. But even seeing the small listenership we have and the occasional email we get, like, I can't believe that there are humans out there that listen to me and my friend Michael talking about our opinions of like Belle's Enchanted Christmas, but they're out there and they list, they find, and I haven't spent a dime. One of our New Year's resolutions this year was to like actually make an attempt at least advertising the show a little bit, because we haven't, but like someone's finding it, they're listening to it. And I kind of get it. Like I know what genre a band I'm in is working in, and I kind of know, you know, where to go. And with this, it's just like two dudes talking about the goofiest stuff and people find it and listen to it. And I'm like, what are you doing? But also I do the exact same thing. So I guess I sort of understand it.
Yeah. But, you know, people are sort of starved for content because they're so used to getting content, especially free content or subscriber content. So I thought about this one day, and I'm a baseball fan, and so I watched the Royals.
Same
and
here.
The Royals are not
my beloved Indians are changing their name this year. Thank goodness.
Yeah, I that's a whole other conversation, but that's such an interesting thing. But the Indians and the Royals play each other, so you know that the Royals are not very good. And then for about 5 years, they ramped up and their talent produced and they were good. And so people that were into the Royals were like starved for Royals content. And what I would do is I would listen to the pregame, I would listen to the entire game, and then I would listen to the postgame, where the same people would call in every single night.
And
just to talk about the game with the host. And I'm like, why do people, I would never call, but I always like got a kick out of these people who called. And it was this like comfort zone thing. Like I did it while I was cleaning baby bottles or whatever. And that's what the thing, that's what the show is for people. So they love content and then they love things like these, you know, like different themes, or they like different companies or brands. And then you just merge those two things and you try not to get in the way of, you know, the thing that people like. You try to like amplify what they like.
Yeah. And I think with your show, both shows, but the 30-28 is probably the one I've listened to the most. And I do think there's a difference between listening to people talk about something they genuinely, So there's two podcasts I personally gravitate towards, which is people who have a conversation that I like listening to. And then there's people who are talking about something that I'm interested in. Cause I feel like there's a lot of good podcasts, you know, about things that I don't have any interest in, but the dialogue is what draws me. Like I like the people talking about stuff.
That makes sense. Yeah.
You guys kind of hit both because you have a great back and forth, and also I'm Disney obsessive, so that helps. But there's definitely a difference between, you can tell when there's two people talking about something that they are genuinely interested in, and they're doing it, they're taking time out of their day to discuss this thing. And there's no, you know, there's no profit to be made. There's no like, hey, we can't speak ill of X, Y, and Z because we're going to bite the hand that feeds us, right? Or we're not going to do a show about how great the food is at this one restaurant because we got a free meal or whatever. And you know, I don't know. I'm trying to speak generally, not to make anybody mad who might listen to this show. But it strikes me as very genuine the way you guys talk about it, which I appreciate.
Yeah. And I think sometimes I probably hold back. I mean, I kind of explained that to you off the air, is that I don't want people to come to the show and, you know, people don't come to the show to hear me, you know, critique Disney. Like I can do that in my own time, or I can do that on my Twitter feed or whatever. Like that's not why people come to the show. So people come to the show expecting a product or certain content, and I try to live up to what that promise is. And you know, that goes back a long way for me, because I grew up doing commercial radio. And so, you know, what you promise is what you should deliver. And so that's what I do. So I've never done any of this for free passes. In fact, I've never received free passes for anything. I've never received free dining for anything. Trust me, I wish I would have at some point. I'll tell you what, the only thing that I ever get that's free is like occasionally a listener who's written a book or something will send me a book, and they'll be like, hey, you want to read my book? And then maybe we can talk about it on your show. And I'll be like, that's cool. I can do that.
You know, I'd like to at least get to that point, because I buy a lot of books, and actually last year I read a book that will remain nameless, and I reached out to the author and I was like, hey, loved your book. Would you like to talk to me for like a half hour about the book? And he was just like, nah. I was like, wow. Well, okay. Sorry I asked.
And maybe he didn't want to promote the book. I don't know what people's reasons are for anything, but I think I've developed some good, that's the thing, like developing good relationships with people and people understanding, like some people are out to do this to like make a name because they want to be critical for, you know, the sake of criticism. And some people do this because they want to make money or whatever. But I think if you listen to my shows or listen to me, like I think you come, hopefully you come to the conclusion that like, that's never been who I am. Like I have a job, I get paid, I have benefits, and that's great. This is not why I do this.
For the record, if anybody from Disney is listening, I will take any benefits you want to throw my way.
I'm getting tired of paying for those annual passes. I can tell you.
I will eat anywhere you want, and you know, whatever. So, okay. I have two very
leave it to a musician to sell out that fast.
Oh man, okay, on a dime. I got kids to feed, man. I'll yeah. You want me to talk about how great a new entree is? I'm there. So I got two pre-written Disney questions, and then we'll move on to kind of the bigger topic, and I'll try not to keep you on the phone too long. So the first one is, because you've been going to the park so long, what is something that you've experienced that has gone away that you wish was still around that other people could experience? And I thought about this because I only go maybe every 2 to 3 years. It's kind of what I can manage. And I was so excited to go last year and see the Epcot Forever show. Like, I never get to see something that's like limited time only, ever.
Okay.
And so yeah. I was so pumped, even if the Epcot Forever show stunk, I was like excited just to like have seen something that was not going to be there forever. So what's something, it could be an attraction or whatever, what's something that you got to do that you're thankful for being involved at the time and wish other people could do?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you two answers. Number one, I'm going to give you the Disney podcaster answer. And then I'm going to give you my real answer.
Okay.
So the Disney podcaster answer is Future World. All right. So 1980s Future World, World of Motion, Universe of Energy, the Land Pavilion, Journey into Imagination, the Odyssey Restaurant, Wonders of Life, all that stuff, like 1988 through 1991 Future World. Because it was exciting enough to like draw you in for the attractions. Body Wars was a fantastic simulator, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was enlightening enough to capture your spirit on Journey to Imagination or Kitchen Cabaret or any of those things. And then, you know, it also taught you something. Like, my understanding of the evolution of civilization, a lot of that came from Spaceship Earth in the early days. And then, you know, you can still experience that a little bit today. My understanding of energy and even new, you know, concepts in energy and harnessing it came from Universe of Energy and Ellen's Energy Adventure eventually. So that's, you know, when I think about Disney, and a lot of people think of like corporate Disney, you know, Disney Plus, Marvel, Pixar. That's not really my, like what I think of when I think of Disney. I think about that kid in 1989 who got the book about the Seven Seas Lagoon Resort and going with my brother and spending a full day in Future World and just doing all those attractions over and over and over and learning something and having fun. And it was a little, it was kind of sterile. I'm not gonna lie, it was hot in Future World, and it will always be. But it had a connection to the past, and then as an adult, like discovering what that past was and what, you know, Walt's idea for Epcot was and what we got and the World's Fair concepts, like that whole thing. Like, if someone got to experience Future World 1989, I think they would have a totally different perspective on Disney today. And I, you know, not because people today, like, their interests are shallow with Disney or anything, but like thinking about a company where like the man who started the company was still running it and still thinking of the ideas for it, I guess it would be like Apple in like 2001, right? Where the figurehead is also the idea man, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what, even though Walt is long gone by 1989, it doesn't matter, because those inspirations were still at that time coming from Walt and not coming from Wall Street.
Yeah. I think when my friends and colleagues find out that I run a Disney podcast, and you know, that can strike, you've probably been witness to this.
you love Donald Duck. You love Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Like,
that's not really what, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't care.
One of my favorite things is like 3 years ago at the time, this nonprofit I was working for, the president CEO called me at like 11:30 on a Saturday night. And I answered, and he was clearly like in his cups and said,
"Oh,
Dave, is Goofy a horse?"
Like, he does kind of look like a horse. That's funny.
I was like, you know, I can see why. And then I launched into like this 5-minute thing, and he was like, "Okay, he's a dog. I got to go." And then hung up. But yeah, people kind of.
Is that scene in Stand By Me, by the way? Really? Talk about that.
So I get, like, people don't get it, but at the same time, like,
what I try to say is there's never going to be a I mean, I guess I shouldn't speak in absolutes, but I find it hard to believe there will ever be a company or a thing like Walt Disney's Disney from the beginning. Its impact on pop culture, its impact on entertainment, its impact on the motion picture industry, on television, the amount of different media properties and media systems that it changed, and the fact that it's basically one guy driving all of it. It's probably never, I mean, probably, like you said, the closest you're going to get is Apple, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Steve Jobs would not have been so smug and would have been like a family entertainment person, he, you know, taking the concepts and ideas that he did that revolutionized tech, the music industry, etc. I mean, his inventions were very forward thinking. If he would have had this other layer to him that like Walt Disney did, like it's possible that you had someone with that brilliance that could have pulled that off today. Now, what we're seeing is not that. We're seeing even companies that are awesome. Like I love Nintendo. You and I were talking about Nintendo before. Like that is one of the coolest brands. To be able to share that as a 40-year-old with my kids today, like the whole thing is, oh, I love Nintendo. But Nintendo has to like coattail other companies because it's too big of a risk for Nintendo to do what Walt Disney could do or was willing to do in the 50s and 60s. And so like, it just doesn't, it's not going to happen. You're not like everything to me today is so Wall Street driven that like we're the closest thing I see to that today is like Hershen Family Entertainment. So it's Silver Dollar City and like Dollywood. That's still like a family. And then later a board takes over or whatever, but like they still have a ton of influence in what is happening in those theme parks. But here's the thing. They don't have any other properties. They don't have films. They have television shows. Like they don't have that. So they're on one side where Walt was able to combine all of those things. And that's the genius of that guy.
Yeah. That's interesting. I feel like we could have a whole other conversation about Dollywood. My wife and I spent our second or third year of marriage. We went to the Smoky Mountains and hung out for a week doing nothing, which is great. It was a great trip.
Yeah, it is.
But only on the way out of town did we realize how close we were to Dollywood, and I didn't go. And I kick myself because I've heard it's awesome.
It is, because it was a Hershen property and it was basically Silver Dollar City of the South, and basically take Frontierland and turn it into an entire theme park.
Like even now I would, that sounds awesome. And all I can say is that I adopted a dog 2 days ago and we named her Dolly after Dolly Parton. So
Dolly is and to partner with Dolly, like she's the queen of the South and she might just be the queen of America. Like she's just so great.
She's the best. Yeah. She's been providing my children with free books for like 5 years now. So
she is an incredible person. Like, I mean, we could do a whole show on Dolly.
She's the best. Yeah. Let's do it. Okay. Dolly
that
cat.
That kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. I mean, there's really no one that can pull that off today without the immense amount of risk, and no bank is going to lend the money to a new, you know, just that's not going to happen. I know you're right. So can I just give you my other answer?
Yes, but really quick, I want to say that anybody who is listening to this, who is new to Disney history, I'm glad that you mentioned financial risk, because one of the things that I loved learning about early on was how close to complete financial ruin Walt was like four different times in his life. And I think that's one of the most inspiring things to me is like, is a guy who seemingly has everything and is willing to risk everything just to do a new thing and because he believes in it. And like, it sounds cheesy, but like, that's the thing that keeps me interested in this stuff. Like, I find that so compelling and, you know, and I hate, you know, America has a lot of problems, but like at its heart, if you want to think of an American ideal, it's somebody who's trying to do something on their own that is special. And I don't know. I don't know if that translates, but like, that's what it feels like to me. I guess.
I think it translates into this sort of pioneerism, right? That's like an American thing. So you know, Walt Disney was one of those guys, but he was just one of, you know, hundreds of those men and women in American history that are, you know, pioneers in their respective areas. So that's the spirit that the dude had. He was a futurist and optimist, and he really thought, you know, science was an end. Unfortunately, it's not, because we see the other side of science that brings us harm and chaos. But yeah, so like, absolutely. That's the, and you say, you know, close to financial ruin. The guy was in financial ruin. The only reason why you know who he is because he was in financial ruin in Kansas City. So yeah. That's yeah. a thing. Like, he was broke and lost his company there and the whole thing.
So, okay, give me another answer. I have one more question, and then we're gonna get into the heavy stuff for 10 minutes.
Quick
or
answer.
20. I want to let you go. I feel so bad keeping you on the phone for so long, but I have a big question for you.
Hey, I love being here. So the answer is pre-9/11 Disney theme parks. That's you say, like, what do I wish somebody could go back and experience? Like, that's what I wish they could experience. So, like, even somebody that started going in 2005, the experience is so different now. The bottlenecking, the thing about today, even the temperature checking and like all the things that you're forced to do. It didn't used to be like that. It was like walking into a public library back in the day, or the same thing as flying. Like, they rolled out a red carpet and gave you wings and gave you a meal.
Yeah.
The idea that anybody and everybody walking into a Disney theme park could be a threat, like, that never entered your mind, and it didn't inform how Disney operated its parks and resorts. And so if somebody today got to experience Disney 1996, I just feel like they'd be blown away about how open and free and, you know, wonderful it was. And it's not that it's not those things today, but you feel the weight of the modern era on the Disney properties, and you didn't feel that before.
Yeah, I feel like, having been to Las Vegas in my life, and you know the kind of security and surveillance that happens in that city, especially within the casinos, you know, as you get older, you kind of realize, like, it's got to be that times yes. five for a Disney park, right? And I, you know, it's weird to think about, but I remember being in high school and like having nothing to do, and we would drive to the local, we have a local Akron Canton airport here, and we would just drive, and we would be able to walk up to the departure gates. We just sit there and watch planes take off.
Yeah.
On like a Friday night, because that's the people that I hung out with. But like, you can't do that now. Like, no. There's no way you could do that now.
No, it's terrible. It's horrible. It sucks to raise your kids in this environment when you know that there was a different America. I mean, I can go on for days and days about, you know, the downsides and the reactionary nature of things that happened afterward and all of that. But the biggest point is that it used to be a more open and free experience. And I, you know, most of America was also, but certainly Disney was. And I wish that people could experience the Disney that I got to experience when I was a kid, because that's what made me love it. It was just open and free, and you felt safe. And, you know, credit Disney, because it's hard to do.
I'll say that as somebody who doesn't really remember that era of the parks, I will say that whatever they're doing now, well, I won't say, like, I haven't been there in a year, but, you know, I guess the added security probably because of the America we live in, sort of adds to the experience at this point. So, like, because we're used to how dangerous everyday life is in America for the most part, it is kind of nice to feel like it is extra safe. So it's kind of a weird dichotomy.
Yeah.
Like an unfortunate one, but also, you know, now in like, I've been going since, I guess, 2010. And it's like, I know my wife has said, like, when we go, you feel safe. And it's not just because it's Disney. It's because, like, yeah, they have security. And it's kind of unfortunate, but also true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bubble, right? You want to be in the bubble. And so
it's,
you're right.
The bubble. Like, and it's not only the bubble of, like, everything's Disney, but it's also the bubble of, like, there's metal detectors everywhere. That's a whole other conversation.
That's
anyways,
a whole
okay.
other thing. Yeah, you're right. I appreciate that perspective too, because I often just think about it one way. But you're right. That other thing is happening simultaneously.
So here's the big question. Disney is going through a pretty wild time right now. COVID-19 has affected travel everywhere. And one thing that struck me in one of your podcasts was talking about going to Disney right after 9/11. And I have to think that there are parallels between what the company and the parks were experiencing post 9/11, with people probably being terrified to travel anywhere, probably not being in the mood to go to, you know, the happiest place on earth. And while I know there are plenty of people still going to the parks, the news coming out of Disney right now is like they're cutting everything, right? They're cutting luggage service. We just heard last week that they are getting rid of the Magical Express. Annual passes are changing and going away in some instances. So knowing what you know from being a person who's gone to the parks for a very long time, how do these two things match up? And is there kind of a play, like a template you can overlay on this one that you saw after 9/11 and how they came back stronger after something that was pretty unprecedented?
That's a big question.
It's a huge question. And I apologize. It's late and it's Sunday night. But if there's anyone to answer it, I think it would be you. Or Bob Iger, but Bob Iger's not going to come on this show.
Yeah, so. Bob Iger would probably be a better guest to speak on this. However, so post 9/11, let me just, I'll wrap this, like condense it. But the things that you notice going to the theme park, my dad lived in Florida at the time. So winter break and like spring break, I would go see my dad and I would go to Disney. And so the first thing you noticed at the airport were like National Guardsmen, right?
And you went in December, right?
Right.
Like you went during winter break.
Yes.
Right after 9/11.
I did. Right. So
how old were you?
I was 21. So I just turned 21, and then 9/11, my birthday's in August, and then 9/11, and then we're talking about Christmas of that same year, 2001.
Man, I was 21 also. I was, my birthday's in June, and I went to New York in October.
Oh.
And yeah, it was wild. So it was crazy.
It was crazy. It was weird. And having, you know, my friends at Radio Harambe, and like they are from New York. And then my roommates at the time, their mom was from New York. So like there was, even though we were in Missouri, like there were a lot of these New York connections or whatever. So like it was very there. It weighed heavy on the house that I lived in at the time with the roommates and stuff. So we were very up to date with what was happening in New York. But like broadly, all transportation shut down for weeks. Airline transportation shut down for weeks. You had CEOs riding, Greyhound buses to get to where they needed to go or back from where they needed to go. So that's an unprecedented thing. So I think one of the main differences at that time, the threat felt external, maybe. And this time the threat feels more internal, because you're so worried about your neighbor and you're worried about someone, you know, spreading this disease to you or to your loved one, or you getting it and accidentally spreading it or whatever. So Disney is caught in this weird psychology, right? This social psychology that's happening at the same time as legislative impacts. So if you think about Disneyland, right, Disneyland is closed and Disney doesn't get a say in it because of the state that they're in, and vice versa for Walt Disney World. They're in a different state, and so it's open. So the parallels, it's not exactly an echo, right? It's not necessarily a huge parallel. The only thing that parallels is the drop in park guests or volume of guests or vacation rentals, no cruise lining, that kind of stuff. So after 9/11, the parks were very light, and they remained light for a couple of years. I think it picked up again right around 05, 06, right before the banking,
that's a long time.
Banking crash. Yeah.
That's a long time. And I guess one of the things I was wondering was, and you may not remember, but did they take that time period to cut things the same way they're doing now? Like, one of the things I'm wondering, I guess, is like as they're cutting things like luggage service and Magical Express, is this a convenient time for them to pivot to something new?
Yes.
That they've been planning? Or is it simply like
panic and we've got to save money wherever we can.
I can't, like, I would have to dig up layoffs. Like, I don't remember, I remember layoffs, you know, dramatic layoffs in 2009. And obviously Disney laid off 40,000 employees that they had previously furloughed in 2020. 40,000 employees. Like, even at post 9/11, I don't think the numbers were what they were then. And Disney is so much more diversified now than they were in 2001 that today something like this would have an even bigger impact, because think about it. They've added so many more DVC villas. That's so many more employees who clean rooms. That's so many more people who, you know, take orders on the phone. And even though they've automated lots of things that they hadn't automated before, you know, there's a lot of employees that are probably more employees that are going to be impacted. So the parallels aren't exactly the same. I feel like at the time, like, you know, when I think there was a more collective movement in the country to get things back online. And this time you can't do that. So, yes, this is a perfect time for Disney to pivot, especially with things like Disneyland annual passes, because no one's at the theme park and they can't even guarantee that these annual passes are going to be worth any. I mean, what are they going to do? Extend annual passes for 3 years or whatever until people can finally come back? Like, that's out of their hands. So they're doing something I've never seen them do, which is giving refunds on annual. Like, that blew me away more than
that. Was pretty striking. You don't often see Disney giving money back.
No,
they're usually very good at finding ways to take it from you.
I mean, yeah. I mean, take all my money, right? We always say. So you know, the way that they got people back in the theme parks was the way that everybody got everybody back everywhere, right? It was just this added layers of security, this added focus on safety. And I think that extended all across the United States. Now, this is such a weird thing because you have half of Disney doing one thing and another half of it doing another. And part of their inputs are global. Like, there was no Hong Kong Disneyland. There was no Shanghai Disney in 2001. So the reliance on overseas revenues from films and theme park guests and all this stuff, that is a newer thing for them. So I'm just, this is so unprecedented, like, that it's hard for me to actually draw perfect parallels.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, like, some of the people I've talked to, like, is the stuff that they're cutting, do you think it's because, and I won't hold you to this, so, like, you know, 6 months from now, I'm not going to
have you back on. You said they did this on purpose.
I'm just wondering, like, I've had such supreme, if there's anything I've ever put faith in Disney about, it's about guest experience, right? Like, that's what I've always thought they cared about. And like, some people might think, well, okay, luggage service, who, like, boy, what a first world problem. Yeah, okay, what we're talking about, first world issues right here.
Sure.
And I got to say that when you are traveling in a group or with, like, elderly people or, you know, in a large group, the idea that you can go to the airport, drop your stuff off, and you don't have to worry about anything until you eventually get to your hotel and your stuff is just there, like, it's a huge draw. I mean, yeah, almost as much as some of the stuff that's in the parks, like how easy they make it. And so when they kind of announced that all that stuff is going away, the first thing I thought was, well, I have to imagine they've got something in the hopper that's going to be at least as good. But since they haven't announced it yet, I think a lot of people are just wondering, like, is this a pivot towards less guest experience focused stuff? Are we all going to have to, like, take the train to Downtown Disney and then grab our luggage and hop on a bus and then, you know, wait for our room to be ready? And yeah, again, these are things that, like, we're lucky to be complaining about them. But as somebody who loves the Disney parks, like, those are things that are important to your trip there. And so I don't know, part of me thinks, like, well, maybe now is a convenient time for them to reset and input something that maybe they own. That seems to be something they like to do, which is, like, they didn't own Magical Express. So right, maybe they're going to pivot to something that they own completely so that they don't have to pay somebody else to provide it. But since they haven't announced that, nobody really knows. So what's your gut instinct telling you about that?
My gut instinct is that the contract with Mears cost a lot of money. And if you're laying off 40,000 people, then you and you know, you want to get parks back online, you're going to have to get, you know, employees back. Let's hope that that's part of the plan. You've cut college program stuff. So your focus has to be on operations, right? They still have resorts that are not open. You know what I mean? Like, you can only use part of your DVC points right now. I mean, there's all of these little things that like are part of the equation that like we aren't seeing, but they see. So the revenue streams, the contracts that they have, like as, when those are revisited, certainly there's always, or a lot of times going to be a guest impact. It's possible that like Uber and Lyft are part of this equation. Like, I don't know. Certainly the Mears contract is a big part of it. And I don't know how much leverage Mears has. And I don't know how much leverage Disney has. I don't think the train solution is a solution. That seems like a default. Like, who in the world would ever want to do that? Take that train from the new terminal to downtown Disney. I don't even know if that's a sure thing at this point. I know that that train is supposed to, there's supposed to be a high speed rail to, what is it, Miami, that yeah. comes from there. But this train thing has circulated for a long time. It goes all the way back to the Obama administration, a train between Tampa and Orlando, like all these different trains. And Disney won't own those. So then their reliance on that is like their reliance on airlines. And so they're going to still have to augment that in some way. So I don't think that's the solution. I think, like, you're right. Like, minivans are offline right now, but like maybe minivans work for Disney. And so what I've noticed about Disney in the last 10 years, and I can just say this with hopefully without sounding too critical, is that they're providing tiered experiences. So if you want to pay to play, you want to pay more money to park, you get a better parking spot. If you don't, then you don't. And there were different things that they had that they took away. Like if you had an annual pass, I think you used to be able to park for free, or DVC, and you used to be able to park for free, and they took some of that away. So what you're seeing is like these tiered groups of people. Like if you're at the concierge level, money's no object. Like you can pretty much pay Disney to do anything for you. If you're at the baseline level, maybe Disney didn't need you, as much as they need the, you know, the people that do spend the higher dollar. So, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say, but I do think that when Disney resets, it's because they're setting up these experiences that are relative to pay to play. You can see this in Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, right? Your maximum, you know, vacation value is in going to the theme park, right? But if you want to add or augment that standard experience, and you want to do it in some place like Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, what do? Well, you go to the Satuli, or not the Satuli Cantina, you go to Oga's Cantina. sorry, I always think of Pandora. You go to Oga's Cantina, you go to Sabi's Workshop.
Right. You pay $300 for a plastic lightsaber, which, hey, no shade. But I love Star Wars, and I would do that if I could afford it.
But you're paying for that experience, right? Not everybody gets that experience. That is not Walt Disney's Disneyland, where everybody essentially gets the same experience if they pay in. Now you're paying a lot more money to get an experience like that, which is a more intimate experience. And so I feel like Disney, when they reset, that's what they're doing. They're finding ways to, you know, get more money out of people who are willing to spend more money, and they're standardizing some other parts of the theme park experience. That's what it is to me. And so minivans, people have paid for those. Maybe there's a Disney service that's very similar to that, but it's airport.
Interesting. All right. Well, boy, I
don't know.
Right.
I don't know the answers.
I hope you're right. And, you know,
I don't think they know the answers right now, or Dave. Like,
probably not.
I don't know. I think a lot of them are just hoping to maintain employment. I really do.
Yeah. Having talked to some people who work there, it's tough. And I said this on the show a couple weeks ago when I talked to my friend Karen, who works down there. Like, you know, the pandemic has been going on for, 8-10 months now, and seeing my own hometown get hit and seeing restaurants close and bars close and all kinds of things change, like, none of it really got to me. But then, like, reading the news that like Festival of the Lion King actors had been laid off.
Right.
Like, because it's like that's the thing. That's the place that I go. Like, even when I, you know, when you're at work in your cube or whatever, and you pull up YouTube videos or YouTube songs or YouTube playlists of, you know, Epcot songs or Animal Kingdom songs, it's kind of like this nice thing that like, hey, I'm going to go back there someday. And all this stuff is happening today and I can't wait to get back there. And seeing that stuff stop, like for me, made the pandemic more real than seeing it hit my hometown, which is a weird thing to say, but it's true, you know,
because that's your bubble.
Yeah. Well, that's your escape. Mm-hmm. And seeing your escape and your happy place get decimated is like different than seeing the dive bar downtown go out of business. Cause it's like, well, yeah, I never went there anyways. So, you know,
we're kind of used to that, right? Dive bars come in and out in, you know, non pandemic times, you know?
Right. Exactly.
But Disney doesn't reduce services on a dramatic scale unless there's a major, major thing, you know, happening at the time. So they've really ramped up like services and they've ramped up offerings over the course of the last 15 years, basically since Bob Iger, right? A reinvestment in DVC and all this other stuff. And to see them sort of pull back on that is kind of a scary thing. It makes you wonder like how much trouble they might actually be in financially, because almost everything that happens with that company is driven through Wall Street. And so if they're, you know, taking a hit on their revenue streams, and they definitely are in the theater, how many other aspects of this very diversified company is that impacting? It has to be a lot. You and I might be able to absorb, you know, 10 months of losses at our pineapple whip stand in town, right? Because we could just shut it down for a few months and open it back up. But think of how many people just depend on Disney for a salary, and they're paying out salaries and they're paying out benefits. Like, there's so many layers of logistics happening at that company. It's such a big company. I mean, it's one of the five largest conglomerates in the world. This has to be taking a tremendous toll on not only their future plans, but their current ability to operate and pay their staff. So I try to be very conscientious when I think about that, because someone's depending on them for a paycheck. So if I have to grab my luggage, like I'm willing to do that if that means that the company survives and people get their jobs back. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think one of the weirdest things we're facing with the pandemic is highlighted by what we're talking about, which is reading the book Disney War by James Stewart.
Yeah.
You know, reading that, I read that about, I want to say 3 years ago. And so like thinking about Disney's 2019, like,
wow.
I mean, think about how many movies they had in the theater. I mean, what they had, like 7 of the 10 highest grossing movies of the year in 2019. I mean, they're making money hand over fist.
Yes.
The parks were firing on all cylinders. Think about like think about all the attractions they announced.
Yes.
I mean, they were going on a building spree.
Yes.
This year.
Yes.
And when you read Disney War and you see the shape the company was in before they brought in Michael Eisner and Frank Wells, and like the idea that somebody could actually like try to attempt a hostile takeover and possibly sell the company off for pieces, reading that in the context of like 2018, 2019, it's like, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. I mean, look at them now. They're a behemoth. I hope we never get to that point again, but I mean, it just shows how, as you leverage, no matter how big you are or how many tentacles you have or how many different avenues you're stretching into, whether it's streaming or sports or news, nothing's a sure thing, which is really freaky in a way.
Oh yeah. It tells you just how volatile things can become when there's a downturn. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that Disney felt that as much in 08, 09. I'm sure they did, but maybe not in the same way that they did in 01 or now. There was some reinvestment in 09, and the films were still doing okay in 09. And so there was, you know, I this is bizarre. Like, seeing a company like this that does, like you said, the tentacles, no one going to theaters. Theaters not even open, right? That's a huge arm of your business. And then, you know, right now, theme parks and Disney Plus are like the only things that they're doing. Like a company this big.
Yeah, it's wild. Although I don't know, it's interesting that they have not pivoted. Like you see, HBO Max is pushing all of the movies that have come from Warner Brothers, and so they haven't gone that route. Like they're sitting on this giant list of movies that they have not put out yet. So like they must have some hope that they can get into theaters within the next 12 months. I don't know. We'll see.
No, I think you're right. Yeah. They have a slate of films. They have a slate of Disney animated films. One was supposed to come out in December. I think it was Raya the Last Dragon. And, you know, they did put out their Pixar films that were already completed, essentially, and one Disney live action. So I think they are. I think they're just holding back some of these things. We've seen it with the Black Widow, right? That film was supposed to come out in March, and then May, and then now it's a 2021 release. So you're right. The things I think that they feel like will have the best returns, they're sitting on those. And that's probably smart.
Matt, I'm going to let you go because I've kept you on the phone for too long. But I have to ask you one last question,
okay,
which was, what was the last Disney movie you cried at? And you have to be honest.
What was the last Disney movie
And it's fine if it was 1988 and it was like Fox and the Hound. It's fine. But this is something that my co-host Michael and I talk about all the time, which is like, no matter how old we get, there's always the one a year, whether it's usually it's Pixar these days, but like there's always the thing you see where it's like your son goes, "Dad, what's wrong?" And you're like, "Ah, nothing. I'm fine. I'm fine."
Maybe I get like, what's the net thing before you cry?
Oh, my friends and I call that the cry ball.
Yeah.
You get the cry ball where your eyes start to get a little bulgy, but you can choke it back.
Yeah. The choking back. Yeah. The choking back of the crying. I got the choking back of the crying during Soul.
All right. I was waiting. I wanted it so bad in Soul, and I liked Soul. I think it's a great movie,
yeah,
but it didn't get me that. Yeah. Didn't get that feeling from me.
I may have actually had a tear in Toy Story 3 the first time we saw it in the theater. So that was a decade ago, but between there, I want to say Saving Mr. Banks got me one time. And it wasn't the first time I saw it. It was like another time I saw it. So I think sometimes when Disney movies get me, and I don't cry that often I think I cried during It's a Wonderful Life this year or something, but I was recovering from COVID. I don't know what I was doing. There were probably all kinds of things happening in my brain neurologically. However, I think, you know, whatever's going on in your life maybe impacts that. And so sometimes there'd be a movie that I think is sad and meaningful and whatever, but it doesn't make me cry. And so if I'm at a vulnerable spot, then a movie like Soul might get me. And I think it did. I mean, I don't know if it was a cry, but it was like the closest thing to it. So that's pretty recent, David.
You got a throat closing, like 2 years ago when The Good Dinosaur came to streaming.
Underrated movie.
It's underrated, but I don't think it's a great movie.
It's underrated.
But I remember in one of the scenes with the dad, I was up all alone. My whole family went to bed and I was just bawling. And I remember saying out loud to myself, "This movie isn't even that good."
Right.
But I was like, but it got me, man. It just,
I'll tell you. Okay. So you want to know about me? So do you remember when the Lion King?
Yes, I do.
Do you remember when the Lion
King? Keep going. Let's get some weird. Let's get into the weird territory.
The weird stuff. The Lion King came out in theaters. Do you remember this in 2011?
Yes. Was that the 3D or?
Yes.
Okay.
And a week before that, my dad passed away. And there's a ton of like father son stuff in that movie.
Oh God, yeah, that's the whole movie.
I bawled for like an hour during the like. I don't. Scar was probably singing and I was crying. But the point is, just like the vulnerability, like that movie got me more than any other movie has, except for maybe a couple. I don't know. That one has been. That's up there. Like I'll never forget that night where I'm at the movie theater with my wife and I'm just like bawling my eyes out at The Lion King. It just didn't seem right. I don't know.
You know what? It probably scored you some points. I mean, you know, that's a great reason to lose your stuff.
I think my wife would look that as a sign of weakness.
No way. No way. That is a sign of vulnerability, which is supposed to be what they want from us.
I don't know if that's true. But my wife needs a strong man. She needs like an autocrat or something.
God, thank God my wife doesn't, because that's not what she got. Anyways,
you're a musician. You can't be rough around the edges. You gotta be vulnerable. So Disney movies don't often make me cry. Saving Mr. Banks got me one time on the father-daughter stuff. There's a lot of like parents, and I think it's because my dad passed away, and he and I were like really close, and so oftentimes when that kind of thing, I see that again, or like when George Bailey is holding his daughter, and you know, at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, like that gets me. It gets me.
That's what movies are for, man. That's when they operate at their best, is when no matter how high concept or high budget or whatever, like there's the thing that you know, ripples through you.
I'm pretty sure that was like a propaganda film of the 30s, though.
Yeah, probably.
So, but yeah, fine. Propaganda films might get you also.
You know what? As Disney fanatics, I mean, that's where we should be used to propaganda at this point.
Yeah,
I mean, half of Disney history is propaganda.
Sure.
All right. Look, Matt, thank you so much for being on this ridiculous show and for staying on the phone for so long. And, whoever's listening to this, if you have not listened to Matt's shows, Wedway Radio or the 3028, go listen to them. You have no reason not to. If you're listening to this show, by all means, go listen to those shows. For God's sake, listen to how a real show is edited. My goodness. Matt, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. It's been a pleasure. And you pulled the feelings out of me. So that's good job.
If I have one talent, that would be
it. You crushed my veneer, so thank you.
All right, and before you go, you have to commit to being on again at some point.
Yeah, we had some other things we were going to talk about.
We have lots to talk about.
I don't know that my answer for 9/11 in the current era was great, but I just want to reinforce that it's just so that's so challenging. I think just to even we're too far in it to like know what it's easy to look at something in hindsight and look at something today. And like, it's hard to make that comparison right now. I hope that they figure out a way to make it all work again.
Well, part of me likes to think that if somebody's going to figure out how to get us down there and take our money, it will be Disney.
Right.
So like, you know, those of us who, you know, because of the pandemic have less money to spend, but are still hoping Disney finds a way to force us to spend it. I'm there for it. So I'm like, it's a weird, I should probably see a psychiatrist, but like I'm hoping they find a way to make me over leverage my bank account.
They're pretty good at that.
That's what I'm waiting for. Like I'm waiting for them to be like, to announce like a slate of things and be like, oh, well, there goes all my credit cards. Yeah. Okay, here we go.
Maxed out again. Yep, here we go.
Right. All right, Matt, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Well, there you have it. That's my discussion with Matt Parrish from the 3028 podcast. I had a blast talking to Matt. And Matt, if you're listening, thank you for stopping by. And by stopping by, I mean calling my phone and letting me record you talk about Disney stuff. I actively stole content from your other shows for my own show, and I don't feel bad about it. And for those of you listening, if you haven't listened to either of Matt's other shows, the 3028 podcast or Wedway Radio, go listen to them. They're so good. It's most of the reason why I wanted to eventually do a Disney podcast, because it just seemed like so much fun. Thank you for listening to this show, however you found it. Please tell your friends. As Matt and I were very vocal, we don't make any money off these things. It's just a fun thing we like to do, and it's a kick watching people find the show and listen to it for whatever reason. So for Michael, who has long since gone to bed, I hope we helped you add some
more mouse to your week, to your commute, to your snack time. Like, you know, take some time out of the day to have a snack, throw on a podcast. Maybe you have an alarm that goes off, tells you to, you know, eat a snack. Maybe you're not eating enough. You need more calories, exercising a lot. It's very late while I'm recording this ending, and I'm very tired. So anyways, thanks for listening, and we will be back at some point.